This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. More than 25 million Americans are out of a job or underemployed. More than 22% of American homeowners are underwater in their mortgages, and American wages are relatively stagnant. Good thing we have economists around to remind us that the recession is over. In fact, we've been in recovery since June of 2009. The tenets of economics notwithstanding, a lot of people still feel overwhelmed by the financial crisis. Wall Street is booming again, but how will Main Street know when things are back to normal? Today, we're going to hear from some experts, including you. I want you to give us a call and tell us if you think the recession is over and how you can tell, taking your phone calls and emails, 877-962-9862, SOT@WUNC.org is the email address. Joining me from WFAE in Charlotte is Mark Vitner. He's managing director and senior economist at Wells Fargo Bank. And in the studio is David Zonderman. He's a professor of American labor history at North Carolina State University. Mark, David, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Mark, let me start with you now. The recession ended 2 years ago. Tell us, first of all, how we define a recession and how we know it's over in pure economic terms.
Well, in pure economic terms, a recession is a pronounced, prolonged, widespread decline in aggregate economic activity. And the recession occurs when things are getting worse. And it ends when they've reached their absolute bottom, not when we've actually recovered all the ground that we lost during the recession. I like to tell people it's sort of like if you were walking along and you fell into a hole. The economists would say the recession ended when you stopped falling. Most people would not consider the recession to be over until you got out of the hole, and we haven't quite gotten out of the hole yet.
And now what things are we measuring to know that we're either in a decline or not?
Well, that's not a set number of variables, but it does include things like employment, income minus transfer payments, industrial output, and total business sales adjusted for inflation in the economy. That's the big four. It does not include GDP. I think one of the widest misconceptions about a recession is that it's two consecutive quarters of declining real GDP, and that actually is not in the definition at all. And GDP is not a term that is not one of the variables that the National Bureau of Economic Research looks at when they date business cycles or decide when a recession has begun and when it is actually ended.
So we're looking, we said we define the recession as over, but of course there's a recovery. As you say, there's climbing out of the hole. It seems that businesses are doing very well. The stock market is doing well. We've seen record profits, and yet the unemployment rate remains around 9%. Why is that?
Well, that is one of the things that's very frustrating. If you look at GDP, now the broadest measure of economic activity, it has actually recovered. We're producing as many goods and services as we were prior to the recession, actually a little bit more, and we're doing it with about 7 million fewer workers. And it means that we've become a whole lot more productive, and that certainly has helped profits. Profits have also gotten a benefit from very strong growth overseas. And kind of the emerging markets are growing 8 to 10% a year, led by China. And also India as well, and our exports to those countries have been growing rapidly. And production, I mean, a lot of U.S. companies produce goods in China and they sell them all over the world. They've benefited immensely from that. They've seen their profits increase, but they haven't really increased all that much from operations here in the United States. And as a result, we haven't created a whole lot of jobs here in the U.S.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about the recession. Is it over? Technically, it is. We want to hear from you. 877-962-9862 is the number. Talking with Mark Vitner, who is a senior economist at Wells Fargo in Charlotte. And David Zonderman is with me in the studio today, a historian, labor historian at NC State. David, how does this economic downturn compare with others in the 20th century in terms of the stickiness of people getting back in the workforce?
Well, this has been one of the more prolonged periods of unemployment, at least since World War II. Now, obviously, if you compare it to the Great Depression, that's the sort of mother of all unemployment cycles. But since World War II, we've had a series of more mild recessions. The deepest dip in employment was actually in the early 1980s. It was a kind of almost engineered recession created to break the back of inflation by Paul Volcker and under the administration of Ronald Reagan. And unemployment there got into double digits, 10-11%, but it went down fairly quickly and went down well before the re-election campaign in 1984, which is one of the reasons why Reagan had such a resounding victory. This time, though, unemployment has remained high, 9 to 10%, as Mark says, well after the economy has recovered, at least statistically. And that's a persistent problem.
And why is that?
Well, I think Mark's mentioned some of the problems, and I would add some others. I think that the housing market has remained in crisis in many areas of the country. I think people are still carrying a lot of consumer debt, and so they've in effect maxed out their credit cards and can't spend more. Business has been benefiting much more from international markets and has not been growing as much here in the United States and creating jobs. So all that, I think, contributes to persistent unemployment.
So, Mark Vittner, are we looking at just a slow recovery, or are we actually entering a period, a time when we are, that we're going to look at persistent high unemployment rates for a long, long time, that we can actually sustain these high unemployment rates indefinitely?
I'm afraid that the unemployment rate, the sustainable unemployment rate, or what we'd call NARU or full employment, whatever you want to call it, has risen. It's now probably around 7%, which means that we're going to have a very hard time reducing unemployment below 7% without seeing inflation accelerate. And the causes of that are we have huge skills mismatches throughout the economy today, where the jobs that are being created, the folks do not have the skills to fill the jobs that are being created. And there just aren't a whole lot of jobs being created for low-skilled workers or folks who've only completed high school, haven't gone on to community college, or haven't graduated from college. But there does seem to be a structural break here in that not only has unemployment remained high, but long-term unemployment has remained very high for much longer than anything that we've seen since the Depression. And the longer that anyone is out of a job, the more that their skills atrophy and the harder it is for them to be reemployed.
I want to take some phone calls. We're going to the phones today at 877-962 out in Ashboro. Tom is on the line. Hello, Tom.
Hey, good morning.
You have a question for us?
Well, more of a statement about I have a business in southern Maine, and I have for 20 years. It's a retail business, and I see the economy picking up just a little, but there is no profit. It's called just trying to keep your head above water, and it's been that way for 3 years. And when I hear about big businesses and profit, I think that's only big businesses, not the small businesses which supports the country.
Were you doing relatively well before this, before the recession? Were you in business for a while?
I've been in business for, I guess, nearly 20 years, 16 of retail. And business was amazing. You know, you wouldn't have to think about going out to dinner. You wouldn't worry about paying it. And now that's not an option.
And are your sales mostly here in the United States? Is that it?
Yes.
So for you, if unemployment remains high, people can't spend, and your retail business is here, you're not going to recover. It's only maybe businesses who can do sales abroad who can actually recover.
Well, I guess so. I'm not sure about that. I do, on the other hand, see a lot of help wanted signs, and I do want to hire another person, but can't seem to find someone who wants to work.
Well, that gets to the qualifications question. Thanks, Tom. I don't know if anybody wants to respond to that. Maybe you, Mark, the idea that is there a difference between big business and smaller businesses in terms of how the recovery affects them?
Well, there is a difference between big business and smaller business. I mean, one of them we've already talked about a little bit is that bigger businesses have more exposure to markets overseas, and that's where the fastest growth is occurring today. With what I've heard from many of our small business customers, they're telling me that their sales have recovered a little bit, but they're nowhere near to where they were prior to the recession. And as a result, they're not hiring workers today. They're replacing necessary employees when they leave, but they're not growing their business because they still haven't recovered back to their pre-recession pace. In fact, they're shrinking their business and taking capital out of their business. And that's one of the things that's a bit disturbing to me. And I got to tell you that it's not that inconsistent with what we're seeing with big businesses. If you looked at big multinational corporations based in the United States in the second half of last year, which is where we've got the best data, they paid more out in dividends to their U.S. shareholders than they earned on their U.S. operations. So they had a dividend payout ratio of over 100% on their U.S. operations. Now, what they are saying, in effect, is that they do not see a profitable avenue to invest their cash here in the United States.
David,
as a result, they're paying it out to shareholders.
Let me ask you a question about this idea of raising the roof on what is considered full employment to 7%. Are there things fundamentally that look different to you over time that may make that true?
Well, I guess I would talk about if that is true, and I think Mark would know the data better than I would. That in and of itself, though, has a profound impact on the politics and society of our country going forward. I mean, the difference between a 4 to 5% quote unquote full employment rate, which of course is not full, it's still 4 or 5%. You bump that up to 7%, that's almost doubling that rate, and that's we're talking about millions more people that will face chronic unemployment or underemployment.
I was going to say, can I clarify this one thing? When you say bump it up, it's not something that we do by choice. If the structural unemployment rate is increased, it's increased. It's not something that's a choice that economists make. It's actually something that's happened to the economy, and what that means is that monetary and fiscal policies will not be effective at lowering the unemployment rate by themselves. That we're going to need something in the way of public policy to improve the skill set of workers in order to reduce that long-term unemployment rate.
Something like, say, an investment in education with a real multiplier effect. So instead of, say, laying off teachers, you would actually hire more teachers in this environment for a long-term effect. I tell you what, I'm up against a break right now. We'll come back, talk more about that possibility and others in terms of public policy. On the state of things, taking your phone calls, 877-962-9862. Is the recession over for you? Talk about it on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today we're talking about the recession. Economists say it ended 2 years ago. What do you say? Have you recovered from the recession? What about people who are around you? How do you know? Taking your calls at 877-962-9862, SOT@WNC.org is the email address. My guests are Mark Vittner, Managing Director and Senior Economist at Wells Fargo. David Zondeman is a professor of American Labor History at NC State. Mark, just before the break, you were talking about the fact that this, and David Zondeman as well, if for whatever economic reasons, we may have to settle for a new full employment rate of 7%, nearly double what we accept now, does that mean there are public policy implications? What do you do? Because those workers are also consumers, and they would have an impact, it would seem to me, on business.
Well, they're producers. That's one of the that comes first, is that they would be producing output if they were employed. And if we have fewer people working in the economy, our long-term budget deficits are going to be larger, even larger than what's projected today. And so we have a real revenue problem for the federal government and for state and local governments if full employment is higher. And then, of course, if they're not producing, they're not getting paid or not getting paid as much. And we don't have that. We don't have consumption growing as strongly. And this is, in fact, is in our forecast. And we just wrote a paper on cyclical versus structural unemployment and whether the increase in structural unemployment is short term or temporary. And there are economists out there that are arguing that things are temporary, but I just don't see it. And I think a lot of this stems out of globalization, and that globalization is not going away. And the problems that we're seeing in our labor market are similar to the problems that we're seeing in North Africa and the Middle East, where you see the uprisings there, the problems that we're seeing in Europe, where there are just aren't as many opportunities for unskilled workers, particularly unskilled young workers, as there used to be.
David Zondervan?
Well, I would add, if you look globally, there's also the problem of unemployment rates among educated young workers. I mean, part of what's fueling the Middle East is actually unemployed college-educated people. And I know in countries like Spain, the unemployment rate among the young people with college degrees is astronomical. But I agree that I think if this is going to be the quote-unquote new normal, we have to have a deep, deep policy discussion, and we're not having that right now. We need to think about investing in not just education as one single thing, but as really a multifaceted, stronger K-12, more options at the community college level. We are de-investing in our state universities all over the country, not just here in North Carolina. And in the long term, that to me makes no sense. And I would argue we also need to think, we need to think of our position in the global economy. Where can we still be competitive, whether it's in manufacturing, service, and then in turn invest both privately and, I would argue, publicly in those areas where we can be competitive and invest in the education to make our people competitive in those areas.
But, Mark Vidner, I did read the policy paper and the paper that you wrote at Wells Fargo, and one of the things you suggest is that the huge deficits, you've mentioned those already, are creating problems for the government in terms of investing in economic development. And as you said in the paper, it limits the government's options for reducing corporate taxes. But wouldn't, at this point, just because unemployment is so high, would it be wise to tax those corporations that are doing well in order to make the investments that David talked about so that we could reduce unemployment and get people back to production and consumption?
Well,
don't we have to raise taxes first right now because things are tough?
One of the problems that we have is that we have our corporate tax rate is relatively high. Now, that doesn't mean that companies pay that high tax rate because they can avoid it. And what would be better is if we would devise a corporate tax system that would collect more revenue. Right now, there's really no incentive for companies to bring those profits that they're earning overseas back into the U.S. because they have to pay one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world for have the privilege of investing in an economy that's growing 2%, or they could keep it overseas. And they wouldn't pay the tax, and they could invest it in economies that are growing 8 to 10%. As a result, that money's not coming home. On top of that, if they needed the cash here in the U.S., they could borrow in the credit markets, and they would have a tax deduction. They'd be able to deduct the cost of the interest. So I think that we have to look at reforming tax policy, not just looking at the rate. It's a little more complicated, and I know that politics always gets into all of this, but the goal should be to increase revenues. That should be the goal, and however we can do that, that would be the that's the way we should proceed.
Well, so you might agree with David that this is the time for a very large and open discussion about policy and how we go from here. Big policy debate.
I think we need a reboot. I mean, we need to look at our tax structure from head to toe and figure out whether or not it's helping us or hindering us. And I think that our tax system has become remarkably inefficient at collecting revenues. There's just too much energy and too many resources being thrown at how to avoid paying the tax. And there's got to be a simpler and fairer way to do it.
I'm going to find out.
If I can just quickly add, I think that same discussion needs to go on right here in North Carolina. Our basic sales tax structure was developed during the 30s as a response to the Great Depression, and for its time was a model. Was very forward-looking, but that was the 1930s. We're now 80 years later, and there's been each party seems to sort of, when it's out of power, say, gee, we need to really look at what we're taxing. Because I agree with Mark. It's the bottom line is revenue. It's not the rate. It's what you tax, and then you look at the rate. And we're just leaving whole parts of the economy unconsidered and untaxed that we ought to talk about. And as I say, the minute another party gets into power, suddenly that discussion seems to go off the table. And we're doing our state no favors.
Well, let's talk about the local level, find out what's going on here at North Carolina. I want to talk to Alan Wolf, assistant business editor for the News and Observer in Raleigh. Alan, welcome to the program.
Frank, thanks for having me.
What can you tell us about the Triangle's economy? How does it compare with the rest of the nation?
Well, as Mark has told us in the past several times, the Triangle is relatively healthy. The urban areas of North Carolina have all remained relatively healthy compared to the rural areas. And the Triangle is relatively healthy compared to the nation as a whole. It's one of the healthier job markets. It typically makes top 10 lists or the top of top 10 lists for best business climate, for careers, for how to get a job, things like that. This area has really strong foundations of healthcare, biotechnology, the universities, technology, even state government, although with the state government budget cuts looming, that leg has become a little shakier.
This recession, as well as others, disproportionately hurts those who are poor to begin with. How do they fare just in the Triangle?
I'd say just like anywhere else, they're hurting. You know, the jobs, as the two gentlemen mentioned, the jobs being created are for higher educated workers, and folks without the skills are having a tough time finding a good fit.
How about the housing market here in the Triangle? How does that look?
Again, we've fared relatively well. We didn't have the peaks that a lot of places saw during the boom times, but that also meant we didn't have the trough, the valleys that they're suffering through now. That said, the housing market here is still struggling. April home sales in this area were down about 22% from a year ago, and it's going to be a long time before it bounces back. Part of the problem is what's happening in all the other markets. This area is a destination for so many people, and if they can't, they come here for a job, but they can't sell their house from wherever they came from, then they're going to end up not being part of the housing economy, so to speak.
We hear a lot about entrepreneurship, or we have in the past few years. Is that something that is more hopeful in this area maybe than others?
Oh, certainly, certainly. There is a big push. I think part of it is a political push. You know, the politicians love to tout small businesses and the efforts they're using to try to foster entrepreneurs and especially as an economic engine. That said, I think there's probably some truth to the fact that we have a lot of companies in this area that are hiring like crazy. A lot of them in the high-tech field, a lot of them in biotech, a lot of it based on research done at the local universities. And if there is a bright spot around here, I'd say a lot of those companies are probably a big place to point.
All right, Alan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Alan Wolf is the assistant business editor at the News and Observer in Raleigh. On the state of things today, we're talking about the recession, technically over, still 9% unemployment. Mark Vitner is here. He's senior economist at Wells Fargo in Charlotte. David Zonderman's a professor of American labor history at North Carolina State. We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Frank is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Frank.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for taking the call. I like to go back to when things were running well, and then, like an engine, when it starts rattling and smoking, you try to figure out what it was that's gone wrong. And this whole business with NAFTA has circumvented the constitutional provision that allows Congress to raise revenue through excise and tariff. And when we let American companies go abroad, manufacture their product, and then come back and sell it into this country duty-free, it was the beginning of the problem. And then to let Red China, our nemesis in the modern day, bring their goods in here, undercut us, run us essentially out of business until there are no manufacturing facilities in here anymore. And I cite Delta Manufacturing, one of the biggest injection molding companies in the southeast over here in Raleigh, that is now empty. Now, if we want injection molded equipment or cases and so forth, we have to buy them from Red China at an inflated dollar that is consistently undervalued.
So you're talking about foreign exports, globalization. How big a part of the problem is that, Frank? It's a very good question.
It is a tremendous problem. And one more thing. I put myself through school in the summer doing the jobs, cutting grass, blowing leaves, the menial labor that we have now somehow are too dignified to do. And when I graduated from UNC, it was without any debt whatsoever and a Rambler that was worth almost $150, and I did just fine.
All right, Frank, thank you very much. Let's get a comment. Mark Vitner, let's talk first about globalization. We certainly have talked about that. It's been going on for a while. It's not going to change anytime soon. Should we change our policies?
Well, I think we'd have a very hard time changing our policies. And you know, I was thinking as to how far back you would have to go to find when things were going well. I mean, it was I think you'd have to go way back prior to, you know, probably sometime in the 60s when things were actually going well. We've been kicking the can down the road in economic policy and trying and not making the hard choices for quite some time. And I think that a big part of our problem started back in with the Arab oil embargo when we had a productivity shock which slowed income growth. And so we sent our spouses to work and became two income households. And after we got done doing that and had all our spouses working, we sent our house to work and leveraged it up. And in 2007, the house got laid off. So I think it's you have to go back a long time to find a period of time where things were just kind of humming along. It's not any one thing. But in terms of globalization, certainly NAFTA and the granting of most favored nation status to China in 1999 accelerated the decline in basic manufacturing in North Carolina. It weighed on the Carolinas heavier than it has in other parts of the country. That's not to say that they were bad things, but they did have huge ramifications for the economy here in North Carolina. Essentially, what happened is with the emergence of China, it was sort of like you took your global supply curve and you shifted it to the right. But because there's not a lot of income in China, the demand curve didn't shift as far to the right, and we got more goods and more services at a lower price, and we had a huge labor shock. And the effect of that is that labor-intensive activities in the United States became less competitive, and capital-intensive industries became more competitive. And that's why the returns to education have actually increased. But if you don't have a higher education, it's much harder for you to get a job. So the listener is right in that, and to the root causes of many of our troubles. I just don't think that that going back on the free trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, or rolling back trade with China is going to be the solution. I don't think that that's a viable alternative.
David,
yeah, just picking up on what Mark said, it is true that quote unquote when things were going right. The period between 1945 and 1973, and Mark's exactly right, 73 is the Arab oil embargo. But that nearly 30-year period is the period in our entire history, going all the way back to our founding to the present day, when we had the most consistent, steady economic growth on a yearly basis. And the recessions we had were the fewest and the shallowest. And it's due to a number of factors. I mean, one key is we were the only major industrial power to come out of World War II that wasn't bombed to smithereens. I don't want to repeat that situation again, but I will raise two other factors that people today don't want to acknowledge very often in the political discussion. One is it was the period when our labor movement was very strong and developing strong wages, which meant strong middle class consumption, good health care, benefit plans, pensions. The other was it's when our income tax system was the most progressive in its rates. And again, Mark made a very good point before. Rates aren't everything. We have to look at what's taxed and whether people abide by the rules or not. But the massive lowering of tax rates on our top earners from the 1980s until today has not led to steady economic growth. It's led to boom and bust cycles and increasing economic inequality to rates. We are now back, our measurements of economic inequality are back where we were in the 20s and may even be heading back to the Gilded Age of the 1870s and 80s. And to me, that's not good for a sustainable economy.
Well, there are always pressures against that to try to bring those rates into equilibrium, but they had a lot to do with workers as consumers. Mark Vintner, you talked about now the possibility of making your iPod in China and now selling it in China. I mean, is it possible that businesses, especially manufacturing businesses, have essentially written off the middle class? They don't need to give a boost to that part of the economy. They've got markets elsewhere.
Well, I don't know that I'd say they've written off the middle class, but if it's a labor-intensive operation, odds are it's going to be sent to China or some other developing country. In fact, China is actually outsourcing labor-intensive manufacturing jobs to other developing countries. And if it's capital-intensive, it'll be here. In the United States, in this recovery, one of the things that has recovered and is back above its pre-recession level is exports of capital goods. And these are big-ticket items like jet engines, which are made right there in Durham, or Caterpillar construction equipment, or medical imaging equipment. Our exports of those goods are actually higher today than they were prior to the recession. That's the good news. The bad news is that it doesn't take as many workers to produce those goods. And so manufacturers and industry have not given up on America. It's just that what they're producing here has a lower labor component to it, and it's much more capital intensive.
Go back to the phones quickly. Lily is on the phone from Raleigh. Hi, Lily.
Hello.
You have a comment for us? Yeah.
Yes. Among our family and friends, we have a lot of white-collar workers that are losing their jobs. It seems to me like the middle class is shrinking and we're getting almost an hourglass economy where you're either rich or you're poor. I was wondering if the economists would say anything about that.
All right, Lily. Well, that sounds like a follow-up, Mark, to what you were saying. If you can do it with fewer workers, is the middle class the one feeling the pinch?
Well, the middle class clearly are the ones feeling the pinch, and it's not. And I hate to typify it by any middle class, upper class. It's really if you have a broad-based education and are able to quickly to adapt to the changes in the economy, you're probably going to do relatively well. But if there's something that slows you down, if your training is in an area that is not in demand, or you're unable to sell your home and relocate to a part of the country where opportunities are available, then you're going to lag behind. And, you know, I'm not so sure about the inequalities in income being tied to the lack of, or the less progressivity in marginal tax rates. I really think it's tied to education attainment. And we're seeing that the returns to education have increased in this global economy. And I don't think that's going to change. And it really, people always ask me, well, what do you tell your children? I tell them to study and study very hard and put in a couple extra hours.
Mark? David?
I would just add, I'm whether Mark was going there or not, I'll put in a plug for, as he said, broad-based education. Certainly we need technical skills in parts of our economy, but the broader your sort of, if you're going to go to a four-year university or college, liberal arts degrees, I think, in the long term still serve you very well. And I know I'm biased because I'm a history professor, but they serve you just as well, if not better, than a very technical degree.
On the state of things today, my guests are Mark Vittner, Managing Director and Senior Economist at Wells Fargo Bank. David Zondermann's a professor of American labor history at North Carolina State. We're taking your phone calls and emails. Is the recession over? How can you tell? Our conversation continues. Give us a call at 877-962-9862. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, taking your calls about the recession this hour. Economists say it ended 2 years ago. What do you say? Give us a call, 877-962-9862. Email sot@wunc.org. My guests are Mark Vittner, Managing Director and Senior Economist at Wells Fargo Bank. David Zondermann is a professor of American labor history at North Carolina State University. And joining us now is Erica Bell. She's Vice President of Strategy and Services at the Latino Credit Union in Durham. Erica, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the Latino Credit Union. Who are your clients? What do you do?
Okay. The Latino Credit Union is a community development credit union. It has a very diverse membership. Many of the folks that we serve are low income. And the focus, we were created about 10 years ago, and the focus of the credit union, the objective is to really pull people into the mainstream U.S. financial system. So it's mainly people who have never had bank accounts before, who are unfamiliar with the system and really need to understand how it works. And so we spend a lot of time with people and really try to help them understand how they can build wealth for themselves and their families, and really create a better quality of life for themselves and their families.
Before we go forward, I do want to underscore what you said. It is diverse. I'm one of your depositors.
That's
so
right.
So it's a diverse membership, but you are, as you said, instituted, and your goal is to help people into the mainstream who may at this point be low wealth individuals. So can you give us an idea about how the recession is affecting the people who you focus on for services at the Latino Credit Union?
Yes, sure. As you all were mentioning earlier in the show, it's certainly with, as with any low-income population, our members have definitely been struggling and have been hit by the recession. We've found a lot of people are working two and three jobs. They might be part-time jobs, piecing things together, trying to make it through. And we also find that a lot of our members sort of pool together resources amongst the family. So if someone is hit particularly hard, the rest of the family will try to help and pull that together. We have seen, from an organizational standpoint, our members have been continuing to pay back their loans. And we really feel as though part of that is because we've always worked with our members from the beginning since we opened our doors. We have sort of an old-fashioned system of really getting to know our members and making sure they're able to take on a loan for a certain amount of money and live within their means and really getting to know that member. So we feel like that's one important key. Yes, we do see that people continue to pay back their loans one way or another. We have a very low delinquency rate. It's hovered under 1% actually for the last few years.
Lowest in the industry, I think. Mm-hmm. So that's very low. You do a lot of counseling. As you said, you pay a lot of attention to your customers coming in. They can be on the edge, maybe working two and three jobs. When something like this happens, you've done the counseling, everybody's ready, and now one of the members in that group has lost their job. What are the strategies? How do they cope?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And we a few years ago, back in 2008, we implemented a program, especially for our mortgage program. We implemented a program that allows people to increase their terms with us or to extend their payments, to really, because our goal obviously is to help keep families in their home. That's our mission. So we do work with when those people aren't able to put that pool that money together or aren't able to hold it together, we definitely work with them through that program. Fortunately, it hasn't been, we haven't had to utilize it too much, but we do have a certain percentage, you know, 3% or so of our total loan portfolio that have been able to use that system, and it's worked very well for our members.
Let's go back to the phones. We are taking your phone calls today at 877-962-9862. We go out to Chapel Hill, where Kim is on the line. Hello, Kim.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Have a comment for us?
Yes, I was responding. One of your guests was talking about a liberal arts education, and it made me laugh. My husband and I both have liberal arts educations, graduate level, actually. My husband started his own business in the early 90s and sold it and worked for a corporation, was downsized, and we lost about two-thirds of our household income, and we are surviving on mine. I work for a nonprofit, and so to your point, is the recession over? Well, not for us. It's not. I mean, we're struggling to balance continuing paying our mortgage, and, you know, part of me is really frustrated because, you know, we're very conservative. We own all our cars outright. We've got a conservative mortgage on our house. We actually organized our life to live on one income. We just expected it would be his and not mine.
Thanks for the call, Kim. 877-962-9862. Mark Vitner, I noticed in your report you talked, too, about where the jobs, where there is job growth in this economy, where they are and where they are not. And it's significant that some of the higher-paying jobs that were lost, a significant fraction that were lost in the downturn, are not coming back as fast as some of the lower-paying jobs.
Well, that's true. And part of that has to do with the loss of jobs in construction and things that were tied to housing. We had an unprecedented boom in the housing sector, and the bust in that sector has left a lot of folks that had skills that were tied to residential construction without a whole lot of viable alternatives. We've also seen a lot of job losses in the financial sector, and some of that's tied to the housing bust as well. And that's weighed very heavily on Charlotte. Charlotte had a lot of mortgage banking operations in the area that most of which are gone now, and lost about 10% of its employment base in the financial services sector.
So is there a way, I mean, are we having to restructure, given what Kim just said, our ideas about how we manage ourselves, our finances, even the security of holding a job with a good education? They thought they had the system figured out. Is the system changing, and are there new strategies we should consider?
Well, I think there's always new strategies, and one of the things that I like to tell people is that the economy doesn't just grow. It's constantly evolving, and there's always parts of our economy that are emerging, and there are always parts of our economy that are in decline. And it's important that you're aware of your environment, that you're aware of what's going on in your company and your industry, so that you can anticipate changes and react to them and hopefully be ahead of them. And there's no way that I can go through every industry and talk about that, but it's something that if you're at a company and you have and you get an email every day that talks about what's going on in your industry, you'd be well advised to read that and to understand the trends that are in your industry, so that that you get a better idea of when trouble is headed your way.
Dave,
I would add, I think Mark's absolutely right, and from what I can tell, the rate of change in many industries is accelerating. One of the things, I just heard a report that said that students today, when they graduate in 4 or 5 years, many of them will have jobs that aren't even on the radar today. One of the things we're seeing, it's a classic, I see this among my students all the time, they will come in and talk about majoring in a particular thing because they read something on a website for the Department of Labor saying this is the hot job for 2011. The problem is it may not be the hot job in 2015 or 16 when they graduate. And so again, I think that we certainly want to train people for emerging fields, but also make sure the training isn't too narrow or hyper-specialized, because an emerging field may slow down a bit. It may emerge in, out of a sort of a second angle that we hadn't thought of. So again, I think I'm assuming Mark agrees with me that education is vital, but it needs to be a kind of flexible education, not overly specialized.
Yeah, I certainly agree. And there's one other thing that I think that folks need to take advantage of, and that is some of the occupational tests that are out there, and that that they can help match up their skills and their likes and their dislikes with a whole host of occupations that they may not even know exist. And I think that that's one of the things that is really lacking in our education system, is that we don't expose people to the range of possibilities that exist for them and occupations that would be of interest to them. We do have career days and things like that in high school, but we probably need to have something that identifies occupations a little bit earlier. This is particularly a problem with men, and the recession hit men harder than it hit women. I mean, some people even call it a man session. And I was talking to somebody about it, and they said, "Well, what's the problem?" And I said, "Well, the problem is women mature faster than men do." And I said, "And so they realize the value of an education before men do, and that's why you look at college enrollments today, and they're predominantly women." And we need to do something to address that, because a big part of the long-term unemployment problem today is men who have either not finished high school or have only finished high school and haven't furthered their education.
Another serious flaw, I would say, in our education system, Erica, is financial literacy. And if you think about what caused a big part of the downturn in 2008, it was certainly people way overextended, in way over their heads, encouraged by industries to do just this. With your vanishingly low delinquency rates, is there something we can learn and maybe some new way of organizing our finances at the personal level that can kind of keep this sort of thing from happening again?
Absolutely. Financial literacy is a huge key piece of what we do, especially since so many of our members have never been involved in this system before. But even those of us who have, obviously, it's a key component, something that all of us can benefit from. But yeah, we definitely focus on living within our means. As the caller said, obviously, sometimes if you're in long-term unemployment situation, that's difficult. But if you can get to the point where you've saved enough and built wealth and understand how to use that system to your advantage, and you can then sort of cushion some of these blows that always come up either personally in your life or cyclically with the economy. That's something that we try to teach our members. How do you build wealth? How do you manage your money? And how can you save for an education? As we've all been saying, how important education is, a broad-based education, which many of our members haven't had the opportunity to take advantage of yet. But we encourage them to be saving and really looking at those opportunities.
David, while this advice sounds great at the personal level, it seems to run counter the way the metrics worked for measuring economic progress. Consumption was the way we measured our success, and we consumed ourselves into a very deep hole. Does this suggest to you that we have to come up with new metrics for understanding what is economic growth? How has that changed over time? Why was spending the engine of economic growth, and it became the thing that drove us into the ground?
Well, because some of that spending was spending of money we didn't have. It was credit card debt, or it was third and fourth mortgages of homes. We're in a bit of, and this also happened during the Great Depression, we're in a what's sometimes called the paradox of thrift. And that is, what we are seeing is that some families in the past year or two have been shocked into, for lack of a better word, doing the right thing. They've started to pay down the credit card debt. They've started to increase their saving rate. And for them individually, it's a good thing. And I think long term for the economy, it will be a good thing. When our savings rate gets higher, Japan's example, for example, back in the 1970s and 80s, was a country with a very high personal savings rate, that one of the reasons their economy grew well. Now, they have their own problems now, but that's a different matter. But short term, it's hard on the economy, because if people are paying down their debt and saving and not spending, we want them to spend. So we're trapped in a bit of a tough bind short term, but long term, I think people beginning to think again about living within their means is important. And I just add one other quick point, and that is one of the things I'm struck by is that financial illiteracy knows no class level. You know, we sometimes think, oh, it's the poor that don't know about, you know, how to live within their means. Lots of middle class people got in over their head, and lots of wealthy people buying that McMansion or that second house at the beach or whatever have also found themselves in bankruptcy. So I think a lot of Americans of all wealths had to relearn some financial common sense.
But, Mark, does that mean that at the business level that businesses are going to have to change their business model to some extent, that spend, spend, spend can't really be the model for economic and financial health, that some sense of restraint and limit has to be built in not only at the policy level but also at the business, at the corporate level?
Well, the successful ones have done that, and you've seen that there have been some winners during this recessionary period that capitalized on the renewed thriftiness of consumers. And it was, you know, Joseph A. Banks giving guarantees if you lost your job within a certain amount of time, they paid off the suit. Or Hyundai, which gave you a buyer's assurance if you bought a car, or Subway with a $5 foot-long sandwich. I mean, they redefined the price point for lunch. And I think that we have seen that businesses are saying, "Gosh, we have to figure out a way to exist and profit from this renewed thriftiness by consumers." But what it means for the economy overall is that the growth rate for the economy is going to be lower than what we've seen over the last 25 years. We've consistently had one of the lowest forecasts on Wall Street. I mean, we're looking for growth to be between 2.5% and 3% over the next 2 years. And a lot of folks continue to forecast 3% to 4% numbers. And I just can't see that happening when households are deleveraging and governments are deleveraging. And one of the things that people are realizing is that they are not going to earn as much money over their lifetimes as they thought they would previously. And as a result, they're having to lower their sights as to what kind of home they're going to buy, what kind of furnishings they're going to buy, what kind of vacations they're going to take, how often they're going to buy a new car. And while all of those things are very good on an individual basis, they likely will mean that growth is going to be in that 2.5% to 3% range instead of the 3.5% to 4% that we saw from in the latter 90s and part of the last decade.
You know, David, I don't have much time left. We've talked about this from the corporate level, personal level, and at the federal level as well. Why has this downturn not been a boost for organized labor?
That's a very good question. Hard to answer. I think some of it is that the political and legal climate has become so hostile to organized labor. The evidence is that organized labor unions had little to do with this current recession. And yet it is still remains open season on organized labor, particularly on public sector unions. I find that opposition strange with no economic basis. And I think in the long term, it's going to harm the economy. I think if our organized labor sector continues to decline, people in the bottom half of the economic scale are going to continue to do worse. And that's not healthy economically or politically or socially for our nation.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. David Zondervan, Professor of American Labor History at North Carolina State University. Erica Bell is Vice President of Strategy and Services at the Latino Credit Union in Durham. And Mark Vitner is Managing Director and Senior Economist at Wells Fargo Bank. Thank all of you for being on the program today. Great talking with you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. If you have a comment or you want to hear an archived edition, our website is stateofthings.org. You can follow us on Facebook as well. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Anna Cassell and Galvin Wills are our interns. Al Wadarski, our technical director today. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.